Dorianne Locks is one of my favorite poets to teach, especially for students who don't, or think they don't, like poetry. And it's not just because she writes about sex a lot. As Patty Ann Rogers says, the world of Locks's poetry is rich and varied with growth and decay, with grief and wit, with sex and prayer and fantasy, with those elements, tangible and ephemeral, that compose human experience. The voice is sincere, close to conversational, as it explores the power and beauty of the life force in cities, gardens, graveyards, and garbage dumps, in friends, lovers, and strangers, in the past and present. That's one hell of a blurb, or one hell of a blurb, excuse me. One poem that I particularly love to teach is Fast Gas. Like most of her work, the poem is primarily narrative, but rich and delicately structured music. Listen. Light-headed, scrubbed raw, I felt pure and amazed, the way the amber gas glazed my flesh, the searing subterranean pain of it, how my skin shimmered and ached, glowed like rainbowed oil on the pavement. I was 20. In a few weeks, I would fall, for the first time, in love, that man waiting patiently in my future, like a red leaf on the sidewalk, the kind of beauty that asks to be noticed. The speaker in this excerpt experiences a sexual awakening, but more importantly, a sensual awakening, and most importantly, an awakening to the world around her. Not so much love for a man, but red leaves on the pavement, and a love for the world. As a teacher, it's great if I can teach students to love poetry, to love Dorianne Locks. But even more, I think most good teachers strive to show their students the world, to help them see it as richly and fully and emotionally as this poet, and, if they can, help them love it, at least a little. Dorianne Locks is the author of three collections of poetry from BOA editions, Awake, introduced by Philip Levine, What We Carry, finalist for the National Book Critics Award, and Smoke. She is also co-author with Kim Adonisio of The Poet's Companion, A Guide to the Pleasures of Writing Poetry. Recent work has appeared in Best American Poetry, The American Poetry Review, Shenandoah, Plowshares, Barrow Street, and the forthcoming River Styx 30th Anniversary issue. Among her awards are a Pushcart Prize for Poetry, two fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, and a Guggenheim Fellowship. Locks is an associate professor and works in the University of Oregon's Creative Writing Program. She lives in Eugene, Oregon, with her husband, poet Joseph Millar, and her daughter, Tristan. It is my pleasure to welcome one of my longtime favorite poets to read and teach, Dorianne Locks.
Well, this has been fun. You know, we've never been to St. Louis, and it's quickly becoming our favorite place to be. And I think I'm not going to be able to deal with this. What is the?
It stays down.
I'll just have to pull this. I'm going to read mostly from, I think probably exclusively, unless somebody asked me differently, but from this new book of poems that is coming out in November from W.W. Norton. And it's called Facts About the Moon. And it starts off a little apocalyptically. And I'm going to read this first poem called The Ravens of Denali. Does anybody know the group Counting Crows? Do you guys all know Counting Crows? You should, if you don't, because it's really a great group. Should I put this down?
No,
one more. But there's a quote that begins the poem from Adam Duretz, who's the leader of the band. And he says, "When I think of heaven, deliver me in a black-winged bird." The Ravens of Denali. Such dumb luck. To stumble across an unkindness of ravens, at play with a shred of clear visqueen, fallen from the blown-out window of the Denali truck stop and cafe. Black wings gathering in the deserted parking lot below the assembly of God. Ravens at play in the desolate fields of the Lord, under the tallest mountain in North America. 8 of them, as many as the stars in the Big Dipper on Alaska's state flag. Yellow stars sewn to a blue background, flapping from a pole over the roadside. Flag that Benny Benson, age 13, an Alateek Indian of Seward, formerly housed at the Jesse Lee Memorial Home for Orphans in Unalaska, designed and submitted to a contest in 1927 and won. His crayoned masterpiece snapping above every broken-down courthouse, chipped brick library, and death trap post office in the penultimate state accepted to the Union, known to its people as the Upper One. Though a design of the Northern Lights would have been my choice, those alien green curtains swirling over Mount McKinley, Denali, the tall one, during the coldest, darkest months of the subarctic year. Red starburst or purple edge skirt rolling in vitreous waves over the stunted, ice-rimed treetops. Or in spring, candles of fireweed and the tiny ice-blue flowers of the tundra. Tundra, a word that sounds like a thousand caribou pouring down a gorge. But all that might be difficult for an orphaned seventh grader to draw with 3 chewed-up crayons and a piece of butcher paper, as would be these 8 giggling ravens with their shrewd eyes and silt-shine wings, beaks like keloid scars, acrobats of speed and sheen, black boot of the bird family, unconcerned this moment with survival, though I hope they survive, whatever we have in store for them, and the grizzly bear and the club-footed moose, the muscular salmon, the oil spill seal and gull, and Raven's cousin, the bald eagle, who can dive at 100 miles per hour, can actually swim with massive butterfly strokes through the great glacial lakes of Alaska, her wingspan as long as a man, architect of the 2-ton nest assembled over 34 years with scavenged branches, threatened in all but 3 of the lower 48, but making, by God, a comeback if it's not too late for such lofty promises. Even the homely marmot and the immigrant starling, I wish you luck. Whatever ultimate harm we do to this northernmost upflung arm of our country, our revolving world. But you, Epicurean raven, may you be the pole star of the apocalypse. You stubborn snow treasure, you quorum of 8 who jostle one another for a strip of plastic on the last endless day, the last endless night of our only sun's solar wind. Those glorious auroras, glassine gowns of Blake's angels, that almost invisible shine tugged and stretched between you like taffy from outer space, tattered ends gripped in your fur-crested beaks as we reel headlong into the dwindling unknown. Denizens of the frozen north, the last frontier, harbingers of unluck and the cold, bleak lack to come. So this is not very much of an upper here. So I'll read sort of some of the depressing poems, and then we'll move into some of the funny sex poems, but not quite yet. This is just a little poem that leads into the second section of the book, and it's called Moon in the Window. I wish I could say, I was the kind of child who watched the moon from her window, would turn toward it and wonder. I never wondered. I read. Dark signs that crawled toward the edge of the page. It took me years to grow a heart from paper and glue. All I had was a flashlight, bright as the moon, a white hole blazing beneath the sheets. And this poem is called Facts About the Moon, and all the facts in it are true facts, because I got them off of the Discovery Channel. And we all know the Discovery Channel is like the Bible of TV. Facts about the moon. The moon is backing away from us an inch and a half each year. That means if you're like me and were born around 50 years ago, the moon was a full 6 feet closer to the Earth. What's a person supposed to do? I feel the gray cloud of consternation travel across my face. I begin thinking about the moonlit past, how if you go back far enough, you can imagine the breathtaking hugeness of the moon. Prehistoric solar eclipses, when the moon covered the sun so completely, there was no corona, only a darkness we had no word for. And future eclipses will look like this. The moon, a small black pupil in the eye of the sun. But these are bald facts. What bothers me most is that someday the moon will spiral right out of orbit and all land-based life will die. The moon keeps the oceans from swallowing the shores, keeps the electromagnetic fields in check at the polar ends of the Earth. And please don't tell me what I already know, that it won't happen for a long time. I don't care. I'm afraid of what will happen to the moon. Forget us. We don't deserve the moon. Maybe we once did, but not now, not after all we've done. These nights, I harbor a secret pity for the moon. Rolling around alone in space without her milky planet, her only love, a mother who's lost a child, a bad child, a greedy child, or maybe a grown boy who's murdered and raped. A mother can't help it. She loves that boy anyway. And in spite of herself, she misses him. And if you sit beside her on the padded hospital bench outside the door to his room, you can't not take her hand. Listen to her while she weeps, telling you how sweet he was, how blue his eyes. And you know she's only romanticizing, that she's conveniently forgotten the bruises and booze, the stolen car, the day he ripped the phones from the walls. And you want to slap her back to sanity, remind her of the truth. He was a leech, a fuck-up, a little shit. And you almost do, until she lifts her pale, puffy face, her eyes to craters, and then you can't help it either. You know love when you see it. You can feel its lunar strength, its brutal pull. So that gives you sort of a feel for the book, but I would like to move into maybe a little love poem myself. It's not a traditional kind of love poem, but it's for my dear husband, and you have all seen his face. And he has a fabulous face, right? I mean, he's just got a face for the centuries. And I had to write a poem about it. And so this is it. I'm not very good with titles, so it's called Face Poem. Your craggy mountain goat face. Your mole-ridden, whiskered, stumpy fish of a face. Face I turn to. Face I trust. Face I trace with grateful fingertips, jaw like a hinge, washboard forehead, the deep scar a gnarl along the scritch of your chin, your steep, crumbling cliff of a face, your U-Haul bulldozer crane of a face, face worthy of a $1,000 bill, a thickly poured, stamped, minted, and excavated coin, your mile-high billboard of a face, looming up from the pillow of size, your used car lot of a face, the bumpers and sprung hoods and headlights of your eyes, your die-hard battery of a face, the pulp and pith of it, the flare and slur and flange of your ears, the subterranean upthrust ridge of your nose, your many-planed light-catching shadow-etched face, your sallow, sun-racked, jowl-hung face, eye flash and flesh folds, gunnel rope and upper lip, storm on the high seas thrash of a face, your been there, done that, anything goes face, luck of the draw, fabulous, four clubs, five-knuckled slug of a face, toss of the dice, face. So that's his poem, and I usually try not to do this poem, but when he's in the audience, because it just kind of freaks him out, you know. But I just feel like. We're only in St. Louis once, so this is, you know, something that came out of the fact that we're both poets. We're very lucky, you know, that we get to be two poets in the same family, and we spend a lot of time doing these kinds of things, doing readings together and workshops and conferences and whatever, and we travel a lot up and down the West Coast, especially during the summers together. And this poem was written during the summer that we had just gotten married. And so we were having a lot of sanctioned sex, you know. We were married, so it was okay. But we decided that there was a difference between the kind of sex that you have when you're at home and the washer and dryer is running and the phone's ringing and there's dogs and kids and, you know, whatever, and the kind of sex that you have when you're on vacation, right? So I decided to write a poem about that, and it's called Vacation Sex. We've been at it all summer. From the Canadian border to the edge of Mexico, just barely keeping it American, but doing okay just the same. In hotels under overpasses or rooms next to ice machines, friends fold out couches, in-laws, guest quarters, wallpaper and bedspreads festooned with nautical rigging, tiny life rings and coiled tow ropes, even one night in the car. The plush back seat, not plush enough. The door handle giving me an impromptu sacrocranial chiropractic adjustment. The underside of the front seat, strafing the perfect arches of his feet. And one long, glorious night in a cabin tucked in the woods where our crooning and whooping started the coyotes singing. But the best was when we got home. Our luggage cuddled in the vestibule. It was really just a hallway, but because we were home, it seemed like a vestibule. And we threw off our vestments, which were really just our clothes, but they seemed like garments, like raiment, like habits, because we felt sorely religious, dropping them one by one on the stairs. White shirts, black bra, blue jeans, red socks, then stood naked in our own bedroom, our bed with its drab spread, our pillows that smelled like us, a little shampooy, maybe a little like myrrh, the gooseberry candle that we light sometimes when we're in the mood for mood, our own music and books, and cap off the toothpaste and cat on the window seat. Our window looks out over a parking lot, a dental group, and at night we can hear the cars whisper past the 24-hour Albertsons, where the homeless couple buys their bag of wine before they walk across the street to sit on the dentist's bench under a tree and swap it and guzzle it and argue loudly until we all fall asleep. So there. I'll get it later. If I'm lucky. And then what else was I going to read? I think I seem to have lost my place here because of the face poem. I got out of order. So I'll probably read another one here as soon as I might be able to come across it. That one seems so depressing. You know, I just somehow don't want to read depressing poems, and yet that's a lot of what's in here. So I guess I'll read it anyway. My mother was an emergency room nurse, and this is a poem for her. It's called Her First. Who remembers when she told me the year, what actually happened, which hospital, my mother, the man who died in her arms, gone from memory, only that he was her first, only my mother in her uniform, white, unblemished, or stippled with blood, and his eyes, the hand she held as he held on, long enough to say the wordless thing that needed saying. Her eyes answering, then speaking aloud the only words that could be said. It's all right. I'm here. Okay. Her telling me how she held on, never looked away, ushered his soul into the unknown with a handful of words, a direct gaze, almost visible, almost a color. A cone of warmer air shimmering between them in the bleach-scented room. A thin stream of muzak blushing through the speakers in the hallway outside the open door. The slick, canted floor they would gurney him down on tiny rubber wheels that oiled, spun freely, easily, as they turned the corner toward the morgue. The institutional gray walls, not, thank God, the last color he would see, but the sea-blue corona of her eyes, irises spiked with amber, flecked with green, fully open and seeing him, whoever he was, whoever he had harmed or helped, loved or failed to love, finally, mercifully, of no importance now, as she watched over the last minutes of his anonymous life. His large death fluttering down under the soft black wings of his lashes as he left this sweet brief world and entered into the next, hand in hand with a godless woman who would always remember him, his rust-colored eyes saying goodbye to her, to this life, in a time I remember now. And so, without further ado, I will end with this little poem that ends the book, which is just a very little lyric piece. I want some, Joe and I actually, this book is dedicated to Joe, this new book, and to Colette, who is our starling. We raised a starling together. It fell down from the eaves of my house, and it fell in love with me. And then it met Joe and really fell in love with Joe. And eventually we, of course, had to let her go. But she's sort of inside me now. And I wanted to write this long narrative poem that told the story of all our lives together, and kind of a Disney poem, you know. And but this is all I could get, and it's just a little lyric piece called Starling. Tale, a fanfare, and the devil's kindling. Oh, to be a rider on that purple storm. Not peacock or eagle, but lowly starling, Satan's bird, spreading her spotted wings over the valley of bones, to build a home within her, stark shanty for the soul, bonfire stoked with pine sap sage, smoke rising through her ribs, her skin tainting the undersides of leaves, marrow house from which the one wild word escapes, stave and barrel world of want, of late, my plush black nest, my silver claw and gravel craw, my only song. Thank you. Really, thank you for inviting us to St. Louis. We just had a great time here.
Thanks so much, Dorian Locks and Joseph Millar.